Jeremy and I are appreciating our time in our interviews with you and getting a sense of what's happening for you in your experience, in your retreat. Otherwise, it's not very obvious, to say the least. It's really like the kids get to go out and play and, you know, discover this whole world out there, and the parents just kind of go ahead, you know, have fun. So it's great to, you know, actually hear from you and get a sense of the depth of your practice. It's always, I feel very happy about that. It's like, oh, they are practicing. Good, they are practicing. And you know, a couple of themes that seem to be arising, addressed one of them yesterday about the, you know, going into the thought and maybe not grounding enough through the body. We talked about that yesterday. And particularly this tendency to go into judgment, you know, judging one's experience. It's a form of thinking, a thinking pattern, a negative thinking pattern where we start to judge negatively, critically, what we see in our experience. And as the mind, mindfulness and the concentration start to get stronger, we see more. We see more of the patterns of the mind, and one of the patterns that starts to be seen is the judging mind, the way we judge ourselves and undermine ourselves and are critical of ourselves. And so we've been addressing that in the groups as well, just working with that tendency to judge. Another way that kind of undermining kind of pattern operates in the mind is this tendency to think that what's happening isn't enough. Somehow that the experience needs to be amplified or better or more, or basically that it's what's happening isn't good enough. And so then there's a kind of a craving in the mind that comes about through a leaning. We just, you know, we find ourselves leaning into the next moment, leaning into the next moment experience, the way that the mind imagines that it should be. So it's a way that the mind, the conditioned mind, actually begins to lead experience through the imagination, through the fantasy, through the beliefs that this should be happening, not this. And the this that should be happening is usually based on all the things that we've either read or we've learned, or, you know, teachers have said, or, you know, different kinds of impressions that have been made in the mind. And then we can try to create those experiences or try to somehow think that those are what are supposed to be happening. Like, you know, for example, like if I'm actually feeling a sense of self that feels separated from other, I might want to try to get that sense of self to not be there and to try to dissolve this self somehow, you know, so that I really can just feel this sense of oneness or this interconnectedness, because I think that might be a better experience somehow. But what we want to see is that's how we're moving through the thought, how we're moving through the mind, rather than being in contact with direct experience. So we can know that, we can begin to know that through this kind of, it's a leaning, it's almost like a toppling forward, a leaning out of the present moment. We're just sort of contracting, gathering, and trying to become that next thing that we're imagining. And you can feel it kind of energetically when you start to become sensitive to it. And then it's just a question of the relaxing, breathing, grounding, whatever the experience is, whether there's tension, whether there's boredom, whether there's dullness, whether there's a lack of clarity or confusion, whatever is there, we just relax the contraction into that. And if there's a way of actually understanding that this mind, the mind is coming up with all these good ideas, right? Somehow we've got all these good ideas about ourselves and our practice and other people. We always have some good ideas about what other people ought to be doing also. You know, and just see if we can continue to relax that. You know, the whole of this practice is around the relaxation, relaxing the grip, relaxing the hold that the mind takes. The mind takes this this position. Mind takes the position. So more and more we can trust. It's really trusting the present moment, trusting in the present moment experience. Trust the awareness. Trust the wisdom to lead. See what happens when we relax back into the intuitive wisdom, and then just see what's happening. That's why this question is such a good question for us. What's happening? Just that. And through the breathing and the relaxing and the settling into just this. And then we can, after we see what's going on, then we may be able to apply some of our skillful means. Like if we're feeling very tired and the energy is very low and we recognize that, then we can get a sense, well, maybe I need to do something a little bit more active. And that's coming, that choice would be coming from a place of wisdom. It's coming from a place of, in the service of liberation. It's not coming from an idea that I shouldn't be having this experience and my experience is just too superficial, or, you know, I'm not deep enough, you know, all the ways that we can then begin to judge our experience, rather than just seeing it for what it is and responding in a skillful way. Just responding in a skillful way. There's no judgment, there's nothing wrong, there's nothing we need to do different or be different, and yet there are adjustments. There are adjustments that need to be made, and things we can do to help shift the energy, bringing energy up or bringing energy down, you know, kind of that turning the knob to increase either the volume or increase the brightness, or, you know, increase the energy, just so we can keep seeing a little bit more clearly what's actually going on. But to do that, we don't have to lean out of the present moment. So we're trying to get more and more of a sense of what that mechanism, how we actually do that. So what we're working with is a phrase that Saidao Utejaniya uses. He has a word he calls dhamma mind. And I've heard that, I've really liked that phrase, and I reflect on it a lot. It's like, what is dharma mind? Or dhamma. Dhamma is the Sanskrit. And there's one beginning of one of the Buddha's discourses that goes, what's the difference between an ordinary, unenlightened being and an enlightened, noble being? The Buddha asks this question to his monks. What's the difference? So he says that both of them have these six experiences. They have the five sense experiences of seeing and tasting and smelling and hearing and sensing, the body, and thought, mind. What's the difference? And I've just been really enjoying reflecting on that question in terms of this Dhamma mind. Then what is this? What makes a being noble and enlightened? And the Buddha goes on, has a whole simile that he talks about, one particular one, which I'm not going to do right now, but I love this question, because I think that what makes the difference is the wisdom of the Dharma. Is the wisdom, it's bringing, how does that wisdom, how does the understanding come through the perception? How does the understanding inform our view, which we call wise view? So that something's coming through the consciousness. Something's coming through the perception, which we call a mind that sees the Dharma. A mind that knows the Dharma, that sees things as they really are. And Ajahn Amaro, a wonderful monk who's now the abbot of Amavati in England, he calls it the fairy dust in the mind. Just the fairy dust. I just love that. You know, because it's the same mind. It's the mind that's thinking, a body that's sensing, but there's something running through that sees the Dharma. And so we're shifting our view. We're shifting the way that we're seeing things. We're shifting our perception. Not that experience changes that much. And we know this now. And it's so interesting that people begin to say, you know, but my experience is so ordinary. And people have been saying that. My experience is so ordinary. In fact, it's so ordinary that it can start to be imagined that it's superficial, that it's not deep. And then we get into this whole, well, superficial and deep. But what's that? You know? Because the interesting thing is that our experience does start becoming more ordinary because we're not actually looking for these extraordinary experiences in the way that we were, because we see that that's piling on a whole extra thing on top of our experience. We're simply seeing and allowing ourselves to be impacted by that seeing. We're hearing. We're sensing. A thought arises. An image arises. A smell. It's so simple. And yet the mind can so easily make so much more out of it, particularly when we're not seeing the Dharma, seeing from with the Dharma lens. So ordinary mind misses the flow of experience, misses the process, the moment-to-moment unfolding, changing nature of experience. And the ordinary mind tends to fix things and experience and reality into entities, into fixed things, and isn't able to see so well that this impermanent, kind of transparent, changing, shifting, energetic flow of life that's moving all the time through everything, that everything is that. And we take our self to be this fixed, this solid, this separate, isolated thing that then is moving through space with other fixed, solid, separate things like buildings and people and trees and earth and dishes and food. And it's everything's kind of separated and isolated. And it's this mind, the ordinary mind, that sees self and other. Self and other. This dualistic, we call it the dualistic fixation. It's because it's a fixation because it seems that's the way things are. And there's often not too much questioning of that. It's just how it is. You know, I'm here and you're there and things are this way. And you move through life kind of trying to protect yourself and take care of yourself so that you don't bump into too many things or get hurt by too many things. And there's a sense of almost having to protect ourselves from this world out there that can seem rather threatening at times or dangerous at times, and we can get into often these quite defensive or protective kinds of ways of being from this world that can often feel quite scary out there. And we know that the more that this is believed in and the more we get fixated around these kind of beliefs, that we become even more fearful, more contracted. We might even feel smaller, you know, small and limited, like there's this big world out there and I'm so small here. And these kinds of things can get quite exaggerated in our mind. And we can start to make choices and act out of these, out of this dualistic belief, this dualistic fixation. You can kind of get a sense of then how the world can take on a very, very different kind of feel, a very, very different kind of sense, when we aren't really seeing and feeling and sensing with Dhamma mind, with Dhamma mind. Dogen, this great Japanese Zen master from the 13th century, there's this one quote. There's one quote from him that we like, teachers like very much, because it really points to our path of practice. And Dogen said, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened with all things." To be awakened with all things. And in reflecting on that, I like the awakened with all things. Become awakened with, so that everything we come into contact with is reflecting back to us this possibility of the truth. Of true nature, of nature, the nature that is in flow, the nature that is in flux, the nature that is constantly revealing its exquisiteness and its beauty and its preciousness to us, moment after moment after moment. It said that to be awakened with all things means to be intimate with all things. To come into a deep and true intimacy with life, all of life, moment to moment to moment. And you can see that as we do this, it really requires a relaxation. It requires a capacity to be able to take that out breath. And you know, just as soon as we breathe, the shoulders come down, the muscles start to relax, the nervous system starts to calm down a little bit more. Breathe out and let go. And what we're letting go of is that contracted sense of me that feels so isolated and separate from everything else. We begin to let it all flow, let it all in. So the Buddha invites us to look directly at this sense of self, to study the self, to look directly at the sense of self, and from there, how we begin to take ownership of things, take ownership of this body, take ownership of this mind, take ownership of our awareness, take ownership of our possessions and the things around us and the situations, our experiences, whatever it is, that this the sense of self, this identifying with the sense of self, leads to me and mine and I. Right? The Buddha goes on and on about this, me and mine and I. Yeah. And the way all of this gets consolidated into a constructed whole, a constructed entity. So So one of the very helpful investigations and reflections that we can do to help us begin to examine this sense of self is to look at this particular aspect of Buddhist psychology, which is the looking at the body-mind, what's called nama-rupa. Nama being mind and rupa being body. So any kind of body or form, like this statue is a rupa. Anything that comes into some sort of form through a body is a rupa. And then mind is that which is much more transparent, much more ethereal. So I want us to look at these this morning, because unless we do, we actually don't know what's what. We don't know what's physical and what's mental. And it's so helpful as we begin to understand a little bit more the mind. We're looking at the mind. What is the mind? As opposed to what's physical, what's the body? And as we do that, it helps us start to discriminate a little bit more about our experience of what's what. Because otherwise, they just get conflated. We think this body is who I am, and the mind is my body, and I mean, everything kind of gets all confused. And it's very helpful to start to break that down. So in the Buddhist psychology, when we talk about mind-body, we're talking about what's called these five aggregates. This is the five aspects of who we take ourselves to be. And at times it can seem like, oh, it's another list, it's another thing we have to kind of think about or understand. But actually, I find within this body of teaching, it's something that's really helped me clarify a little bit more of my own experience. So I want us to look at this a little bit now this morning and just see how can this help us? How can this support us? The Buddha says that these are these five aggregates, which I'll go into, the body, mind, that they are these five that are affected by clinging. In themselves, there's nothing that we have to do with them. We don't have to get rid of them. We're not trying to see through them or do anything. There is a body. There is a mind. And they are affected by this clinging. And the clinging means that we take them as who I am. They form this sense of me. They form this sense of self. They form a sense of an identity. Rather than just seeing mind is mind and body is body. It's just the way it is, and I don't have to cling on to them to find out, well, who am I? But rather they're this flow of experience, just a flow of experience. So we practice this satipatthana. Satipatthana, which is the placing mindfulness near. The four foundations, so the Buddha says, mindful of the body. Be mindful of the body. Be mindful of the mind. Be mindful of these feelings as they come, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. To the extent necessary for knowledge. Just to the extent necessary for knowledge. Right? So he says, know the body as a body. Know the mind as the mind. Know the feelings as feelings. It's so interesting when you start to read the Buddha's teachings, he just continues to point to this kind of simplicity. We don't have to make anything more out of it. Just know it for what it is. The body is the body. The mind is the mind. Feelings are feelings. And essentially, that's it. So when we start to look more carefully at that, we start to know, well, what's real and what's imaginary? What are we making up and what's just here and now happening in this moment? What are we overlaying? What's the mind doing that it's building up a whole nother universal reality that actually isn't very connected at all to what's going on right now. So more and more we can, if we understand what the mind is, we can start to know what the mind is doing. It's actually starting to create so much difficulty for us. And then we can know what the body's doing, because the body has its own nature. The body has its own intelligence, and it has to do what the body does. And so as we start to know, this is just the body that's getting sick, this is just the body that's getting old, this is the body that's breaking down, it's just the body, it's not the mind. We really need to know the difference between the two. What's the mind doing, and what's the body doing? So in order to do that, the satipatthana, to be mindful of the body, that there is a body, to be mindful of mind, that there is a mind, to be mindful of the feeling tone, we need to step back into consciousness, awareness, which is one aspect of the mind. So in the five aggregates, there is the body, which is the rupa, and then there is mind, which is the feeling tone, the perception of the knowing of what's happening, the mental formations that come into the mind, and awareness or consciousness. So there's four aspects to the mind: that feeling tone, the perception, the knowing, the mental formations, and then consciousness are all mind. So there's body and there's mind. So we have to step back into the awareness, step back into the consciousness, which is one aspect, to know the mental formations, to know the perceptions, to know the feelings, and to know the body. So consciousness is this knowing factor. It's actually that illumination, the illumination which can then look back, look onto, make contact with these other aspects. So the body. Let's look at the body. What is the body? When Jeremy and I were talking about this, he said that Gil Fronsdale said once that one of the great things about knowing the body is that the body is not a story. The body is just the body. And so because the body is not the mind, because the body is something completely of its own nature, then it's easier to come into direct experience with it. It's not so amorphous, it's not so kind of confusing as mind is, but the body is just the body. So to know the body, what's helpful is for us to see it in its elemental nature. So the body is made of these four elements: of earth, of fire, of air, of water. And to know the body, we actually come into contact with these elements. And when we talk about feeling the body or sensing the body, what we're sensing are these four elements. So the earth element, when we feel the body as solid, when we feel the body as having weight to it, or hardness, or softness, or density, those sensations that we feel are the earth element, the earth aspect of the body. We feel the body as airy, kind of air, and the air element we feel as movement, or a pulsing, vibration, or the tension when my vibrations get a little tighter, or the pushing or the pulling. We can feel that, but directly we sort of feel it as the vibration in the body. When the mindfulness gets sensitive, we can feel that vibration. Or we can feel the breath, the movement of the breath, which we call the air element. these sensations making up the body, the earth and the air. We feel fire. Fire is easy actually to feel, at least for women. I know it's like you feel the changes in the temperature. You know, there's some very hot, some hot energy, or some cool, very cooling temperature, cold. You know, so we feel these shifts in the body, and that, or even some of the emotions have these kind of heat. Heat feelings to them. We get hot, the body gets hot, or we can get very cold when we're shut down, or almost feel frozen. This is the fire in the body. Or the water. And water isn't actually so easy to feel, to know in the body, but we know it through the sweat and the tears and saliva. And this kind of stickiness, the body can sometimes, what keeps the body cohesive is the water, or stickiness, or any fluidity of the moisture. It's water. This is the body. And we feel these sensations. We know these sensations. This is when we have a sense of the body. That's what we're in touch with. So when we, for example, let's just take our hand. We have this hand that's part of our body, and we have this sense of what our hand is. But what is the hand? And this is when we can. What's the difference between the hand, which is our body, and our idea of our hand, which is the mind? So we have these two different aspects, the hand and our idea of the hand. So just take your hand and kind of clench your fist and kind of tight so you really feel the sensations in your hand. That's the body, right? It's the consciousness that knows those sensations. But without the mind having to come in and make anything more out of it. You know, it's just what it is. It's just sensations. Tight, earthy, maybe a little sticky, water, my hand's sticky, watery. A little cool, I can feel the fire in it. You know, or the absence of fire. It's just, there's just the consciousness knowing that. Doesn't have to have any more mental formations around it, my hand, or it's getting old, and but I like the ring that I have on my hand, and you know, my nails are looking good today. You know, more the skin definitely is changing. Now we're going a little bit more into mind here, aren't we? Kind of left the realm of body. So starting to know more of that, the difference of when is it just the physical and when is it the mental? When are we starting to go more into that realm? Because so easily we start to relate to, We're relating to our mind rather than kind of like what's really real here. This touch of my foot on the ground, the breath moving through the body, the hearing at the ears, the hearing, the seeing, the tasting, this elemental, this more bare experience through the body, knowing the body as the body. This is what the Buddha says, satipatthana, the placing the mindfulness near the body so that we can know the body as the body. And then to look at the mind, what is the mind? We've been looking at feelings, this first aspect of the mind, which is just the sense of the tone of the pleasant or unpleasant, neutral. just the feel of that, the first kind of entry into the mind. Because it's a concept. We're making, there's already just a knowing, a perception of just that tone. And then the perception, which is actually the what's happening piece. It's like what's happening. It's the knowing and having a label for what we're knowing. That's the mind. Soon as we come in with some kind of understanding, and as we develop our mind, we actually have more vocabulary, we have more understanding, we have more language, we can perceive things even more finely, more refined, in a more refined way. This is the mind. And then the mental formations, the mental conceptions where we go into thought about things, where we start interpreting and conceiving and having ideas and creativity and imaginations and fantasies, and this whole world comes into play. It's the mind. And then we have consciousness, which is the faculty to know. Consciousness itself is purely functional. That's when we were saying earlier, consciousness is stupid. It's not that it's stupid. That was probably not, I mean, Utejaniya did say that. But what it means, what he means by that, is to see consciousness for what it is. It simply has the function to know. It's an aspect of mind that can know experience. And mindfulness is an aspect of consciousness that tethers the attention to the object so we can know it. The sights, the sounds, the tastes, the smells, the thoughts, the mindfulness tethers the attention so we can keep our attention there and kind of examine it, investigate it, know it. But consciousness itself simply knows. And then through the mindfulness and concentration, we develop more understanding and the wisdom grows, the wisdom deepens. So consciousness is a very interesting aspect. There's so many theories and ideas and traditions, and consciousness is really where it starts to get interesting, right? Because this consciousness, this capacity to know our experience, to be awake, to be conscious. What is that? What is that? Because sometimes we might find that we're trying to, consciousness or awareness, that we're trying to locate awareness. We're trying to find awareness. We're trying to know awareness. And there's like so many practices that start to point to this, to know this. But what is it? You know, it's another way that the mind starts to get very convoluted and very kind of complex around this. Trying to find awareness, trying to know awareness. But in itself, it can't be located anywhere. In itself, it actually can't be found because it isn't anything. It isn't an object of the body that can be found in the physicality, and it isn't a mental formation. That's a different aggregate. In itself, it cannot be found. It's formless. Consciousness has not taken form. Consciousness doesn't take form. The body takes form. Thought takes form. But consciousness doesn't take form in itself. Consciousness knows form. It identifies form, it recognizes form. And consciousness arises with the formations of this world. It rises with the body, it arises with the mind. It awakens with all things awaken together. So there's really this amazing dance. It's where our perceptions get very interesting, where we start to experience and sense this which I would call this dance or this play of form and the formless. This formless nature of consciousness or awareness arising and dancing and playing with the forms of this life, of this body, of this mind, this earth, world. This beautiful interplay. We don't have to go looking for this pure consciousness because it can't be found. Who would find it? Who is going to find pure consciousness? Because unless something has taken birth into form, it's not going to be seen or known by consciousness. It has to arise together. Consciousness arises with that which has taken form, taken birth. They arise together and known together. This consciousness can be known, which is an interesting thing. It can be known, but it's known more intuitively. This is where everything gets very mysterious and kind of beyond the thinking mind. It can be known what we call by the intuitive knowing, which in a kind of an odd way is consciousness knowing itself. Consciousness becomes interested in itself. And itself is manifesting everywhere. Consciousness is playing and manifesting everywhere with everything. With sights, with the trees, with the birds, with the earth, with people, with emotions, with thoughts. Everything is playing with everything. There is no separation. There's nothing that's isolated. There's nothing separated from this consciousness. It's like the ocean with the fish swimming through it, or the waves arising and passing. We don't have to go looking for anything. Everything is right here. Everything is everything is everything is everything is. So this vipassana is much more than just paying attention. This vipassana is really starting to be interested to find out, what is this body? What is this mind? What is this consciousness? Because we have so many ideas. We have so many things that we've read, so many teachings that we've heard. But until we look directly, without this, all of our thoughts and our ideas and our beliefs kind of interfering and getting in the way, and just what's here, what's happening, look directly. And when we do that, the whole world is revealed to us. The whole universe is revealed to us right in this moment, right here. And this is what we're trying to clarify, this perception. We're trying to clean the doors of perception. Mm. Who was it? Huxley. Mm. Right? Huxley. Cleaning the doors of perception. So that we can really see things the way they are. Beyond the concepts. Beyond the ideas. Beyond all the collective knowledge. looking directly into this mystery. I mean, where do these forms arise from anyhow? Where does everything come from? Where did this body come from? Where does a thought arise from? Where does a sight all of a sudden appear from? Or a bird song? Or what is any of this anyhow? What's happening?
Who's responsible?
Who's responsible for this? The other last week when I was going to be teaching in Christchurch, I was spending the morning reflecting on some of my Dhamma thoughts, and I was in this little room kind of, you know, working on my papers, and then I looked out the window and there was this incredible rainbow. This amazing rainbow just appeared in the sky. And I was reflecting on these kinds of things, and I looked up and I looked at this rainbow, and it was just shimmering all the colors, you know, just shimmering in the sky. And I was reflecting on this difference between the ordinary mind and the Dhamma mind. And I looked at the rainbow, and I could see it in that moment through the eyes of Dhamma. And I could see that it wasn't anything at all. It was just this shimmering light. And I'm, you know, scientifically, you know, there's a whole scientific understanding of how a rainbow comes together. But in that moment, it was just this shimmering mirage that was going to be there for maybe a minute or two and then disappear. And I could see the whole of life in that rainbow. The whole time and timelessness and form and formlessness and all the elements of nature. And that rainbow had its own nature. It had its own unique signature in that moment, making its impression in the world in that moment for anyone who had eyes to see it in that moment. And then it was gone. And it was that, for me, felt like the Dhamma. Perceiving with Dhamma eyes, Dhamma mind. And the sense of, can it, the possibility to live life in that way, to walk through life with the perception that clear. And I knew for myself that that was a particularly good moment. But not one that, you know, is going to be that clear every moment. And so there's that appreciation as well. It's like, the mind is open, the eyes are open in that moment. And knowing that it will then close again. The mind closes down, back into ordinary mind, back into reactions, back in demanding, expecting, wanting, craving, clinging. And then the moment of, clearing again. So this is what we're going to get some sense of this. What is it? What is this enlightenment? What is this fairy dust? What is this? What are we awakening to? What are we wanting to bring forth here in our consciousness? So just opening up some other ideas here in the room today. I'm starting to sort things. What's what? Getting more of a sense of what's what.
I had a nice thought with the rainbow, just to follow on, is that we're told that if we follow the rainbow, we fix it, there's a pot of gold at the end of it. And we're sort of we're trained to see it as something real.
Then we get into that whole story, right? That's what it's all about, is getting to the pot of gold.
Yeah, false pot of gold. The false
pot of gold.
The hardest part of the practice is then for me is staying with the simplicity. It's just staying with the beautiful simplicity of being here in this moment as it is, and have that be enough.
That's right.
You know, it's so easy to slip into the complexity of the mind and trying to figure things out when there's nothing that needs to be figured out, because it's all here.
We get seduced into believing that there's resolution through the mind. If I think about it long enough, if I try to understand it enough, I can come to a resolution which is going to fix everything, right?
It doesn't need to be fixed.
And nothing needs to be fixed, right? But isn't it? It's hard to remember that nothing needs to be fixed. The Dhamma means the law, the harmony, the way things are. The way things are. The nature. So what does this stir for you? What does this bring up for you? And also just also want to encourage people who haven't spoken who might want to take a little time too for themselves.
I just had a poem that came to mind that I read many years ago and it obviously stayed with me. And I think Andy just alluded to it, and it says, I don't give a fig for simplicity this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for simplicity the other side of complexity.
Would you mind repeating that acoustically?
Sorry. The poem says, I don't give a fig for simplicity this side of complexity, but I give my life for simplicity the other side of complexity.
That's basically it, right?
To explore more about what we do with the judging mind, because it's so sticky. It just wants to cling.
So what to do with the judging mind?
How we be with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to ask you, Ruth, what you understand so far.
Well, I can tell you what I've been doing. The judging mind is persistent, keeps coming and coming and coming, and so I see it, I'm aware of it. And I can attempt to let it go, just let it... But the way that I'm able to do that is, the only way I seem able to do that is to send it love or compassion. Just acknowledge it for being there.
Yeah.
But it's back. So it doesn't disappear for long.
Yeah. Mm. So, persistent patience. patient persistence is another translation of energy, virya. So, one of the faculties of energy. That's really what it requires, is that persistent.
And is the comparing mind similar to the judging mind? It's just a different way of making a judgment.
Yeah. The comparing mind is another kind of pattern that gives rise to judging mind. Mm-hmm. Judging mind is generally that negative, critical, and hurtful commenting in the mind.
So I can see that the comparing leads to the judging.
There's a whole psychology that understands how the judging got formed in the mind, you know, and there's a whole psychology, what's called the superego. It's when we were growing up, we weren't getting the kind of care that we needed, and so we had to create an internalized kind of ego to help us navigate and function in the world. And so it was a dictate, do this, do that, be like this, be like that. And we actually needed that when we were growing up because we didn't know what to do. We weren't getting it externally, so we had to create it internally. It's what's believed. So that judge is not a bad thing. It's not bad. It's just it's a development from earlier time that is still operating in present time, and you don't need it anymore. You basically don't need it. It's like you can now draw on the wisdom of your own understanding. So you basically just said, thank you, but that's not helpful. What you're telling me isn't actually helpful for where I am right now. Right? So sometimes you actually need to have a dialogue with that part of your mind and just say, I know you're really trying to help, but you're not helpful. So leave me alone. You know, that kind of a thing.
So old news.
Yeah. What's new?
What's new?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's getting firm. You know, there's the loving aspect, but not, you know, you just want to see it for what it is, that it's a structure that developed in the mind because it needed to at a certain time. Everything comes into formation because it needed to. There was a reason for those conditions to come together. Any conditions that come together provide some kind of function. And when it's done, it's done.
But I don't need to ask what I can learn from it. Because then I get in a tangle.
No, the judge, that's old news. It's not current. So it's not bringing any current information. The only thing that's bringing new information is wisdom. Because wisdom's connected with the present moment, now. That's really old, is it not? It's really old, isn't it? Yeah. So it's just seeing that for what it is. It's a judgment.
I liked what you said, though. It's got approaching it with some firmness. It can be kind, but it can be firm. And sort of sometimes we think about acceptance is that we've just got to accept everything that comes. But actually acceptance isn't like that. It's not a doormat. You know, it's like we can start to discriminate what's helpful and what's not. And so I like that idea of being kind but firm, which is what we do with our children when we do it well.
About, you know, the rainbow and that experience. I was kind of thinking I guess I got some kind of sense of that in terms of the formless, just by looking at the clouds, for example, you know, because we put names to things, so we call it a cloud or clouds, but of course that's not what it is.
Right.
That's the name that we put to it, and we do it so early.
Yes.
That the conditioning's there. And of course it's much more than, well, it, we don't know what it is really. Yeah.
Yes, you don't know what it is, and then just what happens when you're just right there, like you just kind of walked into that moment. It's like, well, I don't really know what it is, and then what happens then for you? Like, what's that experience?
It's such an opening.
Yeah. It's like the concept drops away of cloud, and it's just, there's so many possibilities of what it could be. That's where children are wonderful. Because children will just come up with all kinds of things.
That's why, yeah, that kind of saying, maybe to children, rather than saying, oh, that's a cloud, maybe to say, that's recorded.
Yeah, right. It's the label that we give it.
Yeah. So then it just becomes a cloud, but actually, it's much more than that.
Yeah. Then the mind can stop. right? So the mind stops. What it stops is the mental formations. That's what stops. Our mental formations. And then, where are you?
In the mystery.
The mystery. It's such a magnificent mystery, really.
I just wanted to add, there's a lot about the retreat that I'm really loving. But I'm particularly enjoying the standing meditations.
Yes.
Just that opportunity to do that for that, you know, length of time. Because, generally, if you try to do a standing meditation back home or near your home, you probably would be arrested.
It's wonderful, you know, that you really do love the standing meditation, you can do it. I know, you're just making me think about, you know, when visitors come to retreats and people are standing, you know, people are walking slow. It's like they think they've entered some kind of institution.
Isn't there a story about Upandita going to IMS and going up to people and, you know, walking meditation? I hope you get better soon. Something like that.
A friend of mine told a story about how he, you know, just in terms of having a nice sitting, finding a place of a quiet peace and just having some nice sitting meditation time on a rock on a beach or something like that. And just spending that time just being really still and quiet, and then like a passerby asked him if he was all right. just having that time, really, it's really great.
Because it's really not in our culture. I mean, have you been to India? Most people are just sitting around. It's wonderful, it's wonderful. Their mind they don't seem so occupied, but in a beautiful way, not in kind of a dumb way, it's just... Yeah, it's not in our culture, so we have this opportunity. Thank you for sharing that. I really hear your delight.
I'm really frustrated with that voice that interrupts awareness.
What voice is that?
Well, it's like the cloud of labeling. I can hear myself naming it as well. And taking away from the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's kind of look at that for a moment, because it's interesting the way you're saying that, because you're saying that the voice or the thought interrupts awareness. What's actually getting interrupted there? Because awareness isn't getting interrupted, because awareness knows that that thought just came in or that voice just came in. And the only function of awareness is just to know that. So what's getting interrupted? So something about the pleasure that you feel sounds like when you're not thinking. When there isn't a thought. Is it something like that? Yeah. Right. So that's good. I mean, that's a refinement there. Because then what's interrupted isn't the awareness, it's the pleasure. So it's just good to see that, that's fine. I mean, it's fine to see that you prefer the pleasure She's kind of squinting her nose. What's happening?
Yeah. Quite attached to the pleasure, though.
Yeah, that's all. You know, just to see that. You know, there's just some preference and some maybe some clinging to the open, non-chatting mind experience. So, yeah, so just see that there's some clinging there. But it's good too to see the awareness is awareness doesn't care. Awareness doesn't care because awareness is embracing everything, every moment. Awareness embraces everything equally without any discrimination. It's complete, and that's why awareness is sometimes called love. Awareness is love, love is awareness because it's completely unconditionally accepting of all things, embracing of all things. So then it does bring the question, well, then who's having the problem? Because it is an awareness. It's just a good thing to see. Thank you for that. Yeah. Anything else in the room this morning?
Yes. Yesterday in the group, Jeremy, I was working on something, something held in the body, stored in the body.
Kalesa.
Yeah. So, I'm just interested in there's the body, there's the mind, and there's the perceptions or senses having stored something in the body.
Mm. Let me see if I can understand what you're getting at.
So the body has retained...
memory.
Some memory.
The body retains memory, but it's still mind. Memory is mind.
Stored in the body.
Stored in the body.
So the body's like a filing cabinet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. That's our predicament. Yeah, that... It's different. Apparently, it's different than animals, mammals. Animals can release the momentary event very quickly, so things don't get stick. And so, so animals just keep. They know they have all these ways of shaking and freezing and. So it's all just constantly flowing through. Everything's so the trauma, the fear. That's what the studies say, that there's not a fear that actually gets lodged. But because we have a higher brain, our brain is more developed, we start to make something out of it and then project that into the future. You know, time comes into play. That happened in the past, and this could happen in the future, and therefore I have to be careful and protect myself because there's a threat. That's a developed mind. But it's also what's gotten us into trouble. Right? And then that gets stored. That fear gets stored. We don't. So what part of what we're trying, this whole somatic experience work is we're helping us return back to the animal mind that can just shake it off, and that we don't get so caught by these fears. You know, we can find ways of releasing that more quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's
good. Is it just fear, or is it all emotion? Or any emotion?
Well, most emotion that gets contracted has fear. It's a more generic. It's a fear-based. So thought, fear, sort of the umbrella emotion. But then there's all different kinds of emotions that are fear-based. Yeah.
But the storing of things and joy would be stored. Is it like
no. No, we can't store that. Store love, you can't store.
Yeah. Catch a falling star and put it for a rainbow. Catch a bit of joy and put it in your pocket.
Save it for a rainy day.
Surely if the heart opens more and there's more of a felt sense of connection and love, and we have the sense of well-being in the body, isn't that a sense of like kind of storing it in some way? No?
No. It's your nature. It is who you are. You are that. You are that love. You are that joy. You are that bliss. You are that beauty. You already are that. You don't have to store it. You don't have to put it in your pocket. It's already in your pocket.
It's already your pocket.
It is your pocket.
Pocket's just an idea.
It's that compartment that the ram pump is in. Right? Yeah. The cement compartment is the love, is the joy, is the, even though it doesn't look like it to some people. Everything already is. Everything already is.
And yet we have to recognize.
Yeah, that's it.
In the sense of recognize.
Recognize, yes. That's the whole of the path right there. Recognition, remembering. Otherwise we wouldn't have to walk a path. We'd already have arrived. We call that the pathless path. Good. I can feel things are cooking. Can you smell it? The soup's starting to take on a certain kind of aroma. Okay, anything else? Maybe we'll sit for a couple of minutes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.